You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, January 6, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Democrats unofficially take the Senate. Raphael Warnock officially wins one of the races in Georgia. John Ossoff looks like has won. Meanwhile, also on the program today, David Wallace Wells on the vaccine non-rollout. Meanwhile, the Republican assault on our democracy will be in full force today as Joe Biden's election will be made official. COVID hospitalizations hit a new national record. In the wake of Georgia Republicans supposedly to turn on Donald Trump, while Democrats look to what can be done with a one-member majority in the Senate. No charges filed in the OSHA shooting of Jacob Blake. And the Proud Boys representing in D.C. with the Republicans clash with police. Meanwhile, the Pennsylvania Republican senators refuse to seat a newly elected and fully certified Democratic state senator. Lastly, pro-democracy activists and politicians arrested in a massive sweep in Hong Kong. All this. Oh, and I should add also, Julian Assange denied bail in the UK while waiting a U.S. extradition appeal. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us. Very exciting news last night. I think we're both, I should say, hello, Emma. How are you?
I'm well. I mean, I think it's good to get a win.
Yes, it's good to get a win. I was going to say we're both sleepy because we were up. Well, I think we were streaming until 11 last night, at least.
I think I ducked out at around 10:45.
Well, that was, we were on air, as it were, for a long time yesterday. I did not, I will admit to also not sleeping very well last night because I kept sort of half waking up and just checking my Twitter feed to see and watch John Ossoff's lead grow.
Mm-hmm.
But Raphael Warnock made history last night. He became only the second African-American elected to the Senate in the South since Reconstruction, the 11th African-American to become a senator. And he did so pretty decisively. I mean, both Ossoff, and these tallies are not finished with Ossoff, but both Ossoff and Warnock ran ahead not only of where they ran in November of last year, but they both ran ahead of Joe Biden. And there's going to be a lot of spin, and there's going to be a lot of dissecting as to why that was the case. And part of that is going to be motivated by the ideology of the people talking, frankly.
Right.
But there's definitely a story there. And it's fascinating, but it's incredibly exciting. Let's just hear. Here is Raphael Warnock last night I believe this was probably around 11:15, somewhere around then, 11:30. And he is coming on to give essentially a victory speech, and it was a tribute to his mother and his family who got them there. Let's watch this.
My roots are planted deeply in Georgia soil. A child who grew up in the Caton Homes housing projects of Savannah, Georgia. Number 11 out of 12 children. A proud graduate of Morehouse College and the pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, the spiritual home of Martin Luther King Jr. and Congressman John Lewis. A son of my late father, who was a pastor, a veteran, and a small businessman. And my mother, who as a teenager growing up in Waycross, Georgia, used to pick somebody else's cotton. But the other day, because this is America, the 82-year-old hands that used to pick somebody else's cotton went to the polls and picked her youngest son to be a United States senator.
Oof, that got me a little teary.
It's pretty amazing story. I mean, you know, we had I think it was Paul Rieckhoff on this program not too long ago, who was claiming that you can't have an African American win in the South. apparently, that is not the case. Now, what is
defensive argument when you think about it? Because in Georgia, there are so many Black voters who were so energized by Stacey Abrams' run and then Warnock's run. And when you show people what's possible, they'll come and vote.
Well, I think, like, look, let's break down some of the theories and the realities about what happened in Georgia. We know that these two candidates overperformed Joe Biden. It is unlikely that Donald Trump and the fissures in the Republican Party did not contribute to that.
Absolutely.
It's very difficult to say how. However, what is also really clear is that despite the fact that we heard in the wake of the Democratic sort of disappointments, if you will, in picking up House seats and picking up other Senate seats, there was a lot of centrist Democrats who were arguing that the defund the police was a liability. The socialism label was a liability. All of these progressive immigration policies were a liability. There was not a single day where Kelly Loeffler, while she was campaigning from November 3rd until yesterday, and probably running before that, was not throwing all of that at Raphael Warnock.
Socialist, extremist,
radical. I mean, and not only was she not only throwing that to, at him, it was in response to any question.
Yep.
How's your food, ma'am? Raphael Warnock is a a socialist, radical, defund the police. I mean, nice weather we're having, isn't it, Raphael Warnock? I mean, this was her answer for literally every question that was asked of her during the course of the campaign.
Yeah.
And not only that, not only just to measure it in the context of how did people attack Warnock. And we should say this is also true of Ossoff. Not only that, they ran a unabashed, I mean, within the context of Georgia, but even still, a very, very aggressive campaign in terms of embracing things like massive climate change legislation Ossoff was talking about. And I'm talking about in the last days in the run-up to the election, the closing.
Right. I mean, he said he wasn't in favor of the Green New Deal or Medicare for All, Ossoff. But I think what's key is that they also embraced stimulus checks in this way. I mean, it was a direct campaign that talked about giving material benefit to people right off the bat. And that over road any kind of socialist extremist messaging, any kind of racist messaging from Kelly Loeffler's campaign, which they darkened Warnock's skin in multiple ads. So just if you Democrats, they should take so many lessons from these runoffs, which, you know, we'll see if they do. But organizing, setting the groundwork for these kinds of campaigns, not just throwing a bunch of money at a candidate like Amy McGrath, and then everything just dissipates and evaporates into thin air. Creating an institutional framework for future campaigns through organizing, through getting people excited about a candidate in red states where they never thought they could win. This is what happens. And it's paying dividends. And they ran a clear campaign on these checks, on helping people during COVID, and that overrode any kind of red baiting fear mongering that we saw from the Perdue and Loeffler campaigns.
Let me go through, I'll tell you what. Let's play a clip of John Ossoff and his victory speech, essentially, that he gave this morning. And then we're going to go through some of the points that they were running on in the last days of the campaign. Let's run that clip of John Ossoff.
Good morning. It is with humility that I thank the people of Georgia for electing me to serve you in the United States Senate. Thank you for the confidence and trust that you have placed in me. At this moment of crisis, as COVID-19 continues to ravage our state and our country, when hundreds of thousands have lost their lives, millions have lost livelihoods, Georgia families are having difficulty putting food on the table, fearing foreclosure or eviction, having difficulty making ends meet. Let's unite now to beat this virus and rush economic relief to the people of our state and to the American people. I will work in the U.S. Senate to support a robust public health response so that we can defeat this virus, putting Georgia's own Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the lead, trusting medical expertise, doctors, and scientists to bring the tools to bear, the technology to bear, the ingenuity to bear, and the resources to bear necessary to stop the spread of this virus, to defeat it, and to get our daily lives back, and to rush direct economic relief to people who need help right now. This campaign has been about health and jobs and justice for the people of this state, for all the people of this state. And they will be my guiding principles as I serve this state in the U.S. Senate, ensuring that every Georgian has great health care, no matter our wealth, ensuring that we invest in an economic recovery that includes all communities, that rebuilds our state's infrastructure, that lays the foundations for prosperity in rural Georgia, suburban communities, and urban communities alike, and securing equal justice for all, following in the footsteps of leaders who have departed us in this last year, like Congressman John Lewis and C.T. Vivian. I want to thank the people of Georgia for participating in this election. Everybody who cast your ballot, everybody who put your faith and confidence in our democracy's capacity to deliver the representation that we deserve, whether you were for me or against me, I'll be for you in the U.S. Senate. I will serve all the people of this state. I will give everything I've got to ensuring that Georgia's interests are represented in the U.S. Senate. I want to thank all the volunteers who poured their hearts and souls into this campaign. I want to thank my family for their support and their patience. I want to thank my wonderful wife, Alicia, who as we speak is at the hospital, helping Georgia mothers deliver healthy babies, helping save lives.
We get the gist there. And so there's Ossoff, and he was obviously rather tired. He was up all night, I imagine. All right, we're going to take a break. I'm not sure that we have David Wallace Wells. We will see on the other side of this, but we'll take a quick break. And if not, we'll come back. I want to go through exactly what these people were running on at the end of this campaign and through over the past really 2 months that they've been running, because, you know, we have a couple of different pieces of analysis that will come out of this. One, what Democrats need to do going forward to win races like this. Two, what narratives that were built and were accepted by the conventional media about why Democrats underperformed actually showed themselves to not be the case in the run-up and in the conclusion of the Georgia Senate. And then we'll also talk about what this is going to mean in terms of going forward. And some of it's good, some of it not so great. We'll be right back after this. Hey, I mentioned this yesterday, but it is unbelievable what merely doing something small can do for your day, particularly right now. Because I feel like my life is so narrow because of COVID that maybe that's why, like, I have a heightened sensitivity. But the my change in socks has honestly, and I mean, I have to say, I do think it is. I do think it is partly a function of COVID because, you know, it's like I've noticed this lately that, like, small things are making
a small thing.
I appreciate small things.
I feel the same way.
Runners apparently know about Features, F-E-E-T-U-R-E-S. It's their sock of choice. When I brought it up to Brendan, of course, got very, very excited.
Runner Brendan.
Yes. I mean, I don't know. Brendan, are you still running?
I do still run. Yeah. It's cold out.
Hate cardio, so I don't know.
Brendan was like, I have all those socks. Features have, and apparently golfers, it's really big for golfers too, because the elite golf socks keep your feet cool, dry, blister free. But here's the thing that I enjoy them because I'm not a golfer, but I am a walker. I walk everywhere.
Because you're a New Yorker.
Because I'm a New Yorker. It's well, I'm not going to tell that story about my dad, but
okay.
They are targeted. They have compression that hugs the arch of your feet. They keep the sock in place, but they're also specific to your left and right foot. Like, you never contemplate that. You always wonder, like, well, you put your socks on, it's one straight tube, and but you get a custom like fit. The anatomical design conforms to left and right shape of your feet, creates an enhanced fit that reduces discomfort, prevents blisters, so you can focus on your game, you can focus on your walk, whatever it is. If you're unsatisfied at any point, you get a replacement pair, no questions asked. Honestly, I feel the difference when I walk. This is, it's added support, and it's just significantly more comfortable. Feature socks will change how you feel about socks forever. And you can get $10 off your first pair of Features when you use the code MAJORITY at features.com. That's FEETURES.com, promo code MAJORITY, for $10 off your first pair of Features. And also, I don't know if you know this, Emma, but very difficult. Hiring is very difficult. I own a small business, as you can see here. You can post your, you post your job position to some job board, and then you just hope you get the right person comes through. Well, this is why folks should try ZipRecruiter, and they can do so for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter does all the work for you. You post a job on ZipRecruiter, it gets sent out to over 100 top job sites with one click. And then ZipRecruiter's matching technology finds people with the right skills, the right experience, the right demeanor for your job, and then actively invites them to apply. You get qualified candidates fast. How do I know this? Because Brendan, again, I found him through ZipRecruiter. Or really, in some way, he found us through ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter basically reached out, sucked him into the whole Majority Report juggernaut. And here he is. I mean, I interviewed probably a dozen people that I found on ZipRecruiter. I had dozens upon dozens of candidates, and they were all great. It's just Brendan was just slightly greater, actually significantly greater.
Exceptional, you might say.
He was. Yeah. And I'm not the only one. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employees who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in the first day. And now you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire. And lastly, it's a new year. Well, new rear, new you. In 2021, don't just make a commitment to wash your hands every time you go to the bathroom or come into the house. Go the extra mile and wash your butt, folks. Yes. Wow. The brand new Hello Tushy 3.0 modern bidet attachment is finally here. It's stylish. It's eco-friendly. It's easy to install and it's affordable. I think I have the 2.0. I must have the 2.0. It is super easy to connect. I was very, I got grief for saying this last time, but I was very bidet curious because Kyle had told me that he got, you know, like one of those upscale bidets and he said it changed his life.
Wow.
And so I got the Hello Tushy. It's super easy to connect. It's basically like if you can put on a toilet seat, which I know you can do, you can put this on, super easy. Attaches to your existing toilet, doesn't require any electricity, no additional plumbing, cuts toilet paper use by 80%. The bidet pays for itself within a few months. Sanitation is simple. The Schmutz Shield offers easy cleaning. The knobs are naturally antimicrobial. Plus, every Hello Tushy bidet comes with a 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. You can upgrade to the new 3.0 model if you're already hooked on Hello Tushy, or if you're new to the revolution, join millions of happy customers right now. Have a clean butt with every flush. I mean, I wasn't ever going to get my whole, at first it was just like, I'm never going to get into that situation where like I'm, you know, stressing about whether I'm going to get toilet paper.
Right, right. You're not trampling over people.
If you've found anybody who has a bidet who doesn't say that it's been somewhat life-changing, I'll give you $5.
Okay.
Not everybody, just you, Emma.
All right, I'll look into it.
Go to HelloTushy.com/majority. Get 10% off plus free shipping. This is a special offer for our listeners. Go to HelloTushy, TUSHY.com/majority for 10% off. HelloTushy.com/majority. Okay, I think we do have David Wallace Wells with us. Great. David Wallace Wells, writer for New York Magazine. David, are you there? David, can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yep. Hey.
Hey, how are you? Thanks so much for joining us. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Hey, David.
So, David, I think it's been a couple of months since we talked, and we were talking about at that point, you know, where what the trajectory of the coronavirus would be. And sadly, I think you were all too accurate. And, you know, we're in the midst now of a pandemic that seems at least to some extent, and I think we're about to get another wave, largely out of control. And I just want to start a little bit with and go into the vaccine in a moment. But one of the other sort of recent things is just I think it was yesterday in New York. It was announced that the UK strain, they're calling it, was found in New York again with people who have not been traveling. It's all around the country now, it appears to be community spread. What are the implications of this?
Well, I think one way to think about it is to think about consider what's been happening in California, which to me has been a little bit of a pandemic mystery in the sense that, you know, California, especially Southern California, doesn't have a strong seasonality. It doesn't have a traditional fall. The policies were not, you know, public policies weren't changing all that dramatically in general. There was, you know, by national standards, relatively good compliance with social distancing. And yet we saw a really dramatic surge, really straining the health systems, especially in Southern California, but really throughout the state, and making California, you know, for a time, I think it's since been passed by Arizona, but for a time that the epicenter of this fall winter surge in the U.S. I think probably some of that can be explained by the arrival of this new, more transmissible strain. And I think we're likely to see similar spikes elsewhere in the country, which is to say places where, and times when, measures that used to work to suppress the disease and bring the curve back down are not going to be sufficient. And we're going to be even in a kind of, you know, relatively thorough states of lockdown with a lot of social distancing and very compliant mask wearing, still going to see the disease grow for a few months now. What that means big picture is that the measures that we can take to bring an end to the pandemic as a whole are much more important, and namely, you know, the vaccine rollout. And I think, you know, 3 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago, it might have seemed like, you know, 3,000 deaths was too much, 3,000 deaths a day was too much, and we needed to rush the vaccine. But we're now heading into a season when we might be seeing considerably more, and that just makes the urgency even more immediate.
Let me just go back a little bit here. So do we know, and people should understand that the UK strain, as they're calling it, is not more lethal. However, if more people get it, the percentage of people who are going to die doesn't change. It just simply means more people are going to die, and they're going to, and this is going to happen at a more rapid rate. Do we know? And I understand this concept that it's obviously it's more contagious, and so pre-existing measures don't suffice. Do we know where the deficits are in those pre-existing? In other words, is it this is more transmissible because, you know, through touch, and maybe people are not, you know, washing their groceries like they did in the first month? Or is it that 6 feet is not sufficient? Or is it that
mask wearing isn't entirely sufficient? Right.
Do we have a sense of like what it is? If we were going to address the transmissibility, what steps would we take?
Well, the honest answer is that we haven't seen anywhere. I mean, this strain is new, so we don't have a lot of evidence, but we haven't seen anywhere in the world that's been able to suppress its spread beneath the sort of break-even point. So we don't have a good sense of what works. But what I would say is that all of the measures that you just mentioned, which are critical, are also not fail-safe. Even facing the old strain, it's still possible to get the coronavirus if you're wearing a mask and if the other person you're interacting with is wearing a mask. You know, in general, we're not nearly as worried about surface transmission as we were at the beginning of the pandemic. It seems that we don't need to be washing our groceries, but nevertheless, that transmission is conceivable. And you know, 6 feet again, it's a rule of thumb that was sort of adapted on the fly. And while it's, you know, a decent guide to how you might want to act if you're interacting with others, it's also not, you know, it's not a fail-safe measure. Nothing is a fail-safe measure. And if you look at the experience of especially the countries of Europe and North America over the entire course of the pandemic, it's actually been, you know, it takes all of us doing all of those things at maximal levels to even get the disease back down below this sort of break-even point of reproducibility. So the fact that we have a more transmissible strain just means it's going to be much harder. And I don't think that we've seen anywhere in any of those countries, which is to say any country that Americans consider a peer country, successfully doing it. I would just say one more thing about the transmissibility versus lethality question. This is a little counterintuitive, but it also illustrates it's one of the many ways that this disease looks different when you think of it from the perspective of the individual versus from the perspective of the society at large. From the perspective of the individual, you know, a 50% more lethal disease is much scarier than a 50% more transmissible disease because, you know, if you get it, then you've got half again chance of dying. But from the social level, because spread can produce exponential growth, it's not just that more people are going to die. It's the possibility that dramatically more people are going to die, even if the disease stays merely as lethal as it's been in the past. You know, different modelers have run this in different ways, but we're talking about orders of magnitude more death over the next few months, not just compared to the old strain, but compared to a theoretical environment in which the transmissibility was held constant and the lethality increased by 50%. So this is actually considerably worse a development than if things got more lethal.
Wow. All right. So let's move to the vaccine. And I want to start with a piece that you wrote a while ago about that I found fascinating, that at least I think in the context of the Moderna and probably the Pfizer in some regards, the vaccine existed before COVID. did in some fashion. Will you explain that for us so that we can understand that? And then we'll move into the sort of the actual rollout and the deployment of it.
Yeah, I mean, the backstory is that ever since SARS, vaccine researchers were working on coronavirus vaccines, and they weren't able to get it all the way to, you know, true clinical trials, in part because the disease died off and there wasn't a demand for it. But they had developed a lot of what's called vaccine technology that would allow them to, you know, kind of adapt on the fly to a new disease. And that meant that you know, Moderna started working, designing a COVID-19 vaccine, or I should say SARS-CoV-2 vaccine on January 11th. And they finished it by January 13th. It took a single weekend to design. And those dates are notable because they were before the first detected case of COVID in the US. They had actually produced the vaccine and shipped them to the to be used in a phase one clinical trial before the first person in the country had died. So we were already ready to roll this out, at least at a, you know, at the level of clinical trials, before anybody in the country had died. We knew the results of those phase one trials, which are designed to test for safety, not for efficacy, by early May, which means so long as we were comfortable rolling out a vaccine that whose efficacy was unclear, but we had good reason to believe would be efficacious, but which we knew for sure was safe, we could have started vaccinating people as early as the late spring or early summer. Now, as anybody who works in this field will tell you, you know, the timeline that we have is already unbelievably fast. You know, the fact that we've produced this vaccine, we're delivering it to people less than a year before, less than a year after the disease was actually sort of uncovered, is unbelievable, mind-blowing speed. And we've compressed a lot of the clinical trials along the way to get to that point. But people looking forward and thinking about what could happen for the next pandemic say we could do much, much better, because we could do a lot of this testing. If you take the example of the Moderna vaccine, we could have done a lot of this testing before before SARS-CoV-2 even came about, and could have been rolling it out earlier in the spring, maybe 8 or 10 weeks after the disease came about. And that's, you know, I write in the piece, it's a kind of tragic, ironic feature of the pandemic that for the entire duration of at least the American experience of the disease, we had the tools that we are ultimately going to end up using to stop it, but weren't yet comfortable deploying them. The question is, in the future, how we can accelerate that that rollout so that we won't be facing, you know, this kind of year-long, you know, year of suffering, year of dying that we've had.
I want to make sure that we really nail this point, because there are so many people and that I have that has blown my mind. Even like healthcare workers who are afraid of the danger of this. I mean, it's one thing. There's two elements of this. I'm reiterating what you said just so people understand this. There is whether the vaccine works in protecting you, or and whether it is safe in terms of what kind of side effects you could get from it. And so you're saying that we knew this Moderna thing. We didn't know if it necessarily protected you from COVID, but we knew that it in and itself could not harm you. It was essentially like shooting you with sugar water, I guess. Like, how many people are out there that are in the country who are part of that phase one trial? How many people are we talking about that have been healthy with that vaccine, healthy in terms of not necessarily, you know, whether they've caught COVID, but have had no adverse reactions to that vaccine? Like, we have people who are walking around who were shot with that vaccine a year ago, if I understand you.
Well, starting in the early spring, yeah. The number for the phase one trial is not that large. Phase two is a bit bigger. It's in the tens of thousands. But we also know from research that was done before the disease arrived in animals that it would be relatively safe. And I should say, you know, that adverse reactions are almost always visible immediately after you get the shot. I mean, within a week or two. So we don't even have to wait all that long to see what's going to happen. We can really see what's going to happen within a few weeks if we administer it in, you know, a large enough scale. And the truth is, you know, we have a lot of, from history, we have memories of vaccines that, you know, or medical treatments that went poorly. And they're, in certain communities, especially, they're understandable skepticism about being sort of the first people to take a new drug. But it's important to keep in mind, in general, almost no vaccines these days include a live virus, which means that no vaccine is really likely to infect you with a disease that that it's designed to protect you against. And in this case, there's no, you know, not even a deactivated virus. It's a bit of mRNA, which is considerably less dangerous. But I, like you, am really struck by and distressed by the number of people, especially working in the healthcare field, who have been reluctant to take it. Now, I should say the reports are, you know, kind of anecdotal. It's this community here, this community there. We don't yet have a national picture, but there have been, you know, three or four stories that I've read about, you know, healthcare systems in which 40, 50, maybe even 60% of the workers in those systems are reluctant or resistant to taking the vaccine. And this is, you know, I really, really don't understand it. These are people who are working on the front lines. Theoretically, they trust in science because they're working in those healthcare systems, and they've seen the cost of catching this disease, and they know how vulnerable they are because they are so proximate to those people who are infected. And yet the resistance is really quite high and remarkable. And there was a story in New York illustrating, you know, even neighborhood by neighborhood, hospital by hospital, there could be great differences, where we had a hospital in Bed-Stuy where the resistance is quite high. And compared to, you know, Mount Sinai, which is on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, there was much less resistance, which is, you know, again, a way in which this pandemic is mapping onto existing inequalities and injustices. But beyond all that, beyond the sort of confusion and frustration, it also really complicates the way that the country is managing the rollout of the vaccine. You know, other countries in the world have really just prioritized the elderly, which is to say the most vulnerable people, as a way of targeting those who are most at risk of dying and most quickly reducing the national fatality risk. But in the U.S., we've sort of advised a mixed approach where, to some degree, we're prioritizing the old, but we're also prioritizing frontline workers, in part because I think we value, or the people advising this approach valued, you know, society returning to some semblance of normal. And for that to happen, we needed to protect those people who are most face to face with the disease so that we could trust, especially our medical infrastructure, would continue to perform going forward. Mm-hmm. But if those people are resistant to taking that, these vaccines, not only is that medical infrastructure continuing to be vulnerable, but it also means that the whole calculus about how we're rolling out the vaccine is somewhat misguided, because we're not going to be able to protect our health infrastructure. We may as well, I would say, then rush to focus on the elderly and the most vulnerable rather than trying to protect healthcare workers first. But it's, you know, I wish it weren't the case. I wish that those people were waiting online overnight to get those vaccines, but it doesn't seem to be.
If you need a lead, because I have some very personal experience with this, and it's shocking and disturbing. And
can you hypothesize as to why there is that resistance within that community? I mean, like,
I can tell you just from my own, it's Facebook. It's Facebook. I mean, there is it seems to me that there is a massive gap in terms of what healthcare administration, broadly speaking, is providing in terms of information. I think the assumption that we have about healthcare workers is not always, you know, I think a safe assumption. The administration of these institutions are not providing any information whatsoever. And so these folks are going on Facebook, and Facebook is just completely overrun with stories of how this mutates your DNA, how it does not protect you from giving it to other people, right? Can you address that? Like, if I'm inoculated, is it possible for me to transmit it? Like, I won't catch it, but is it possible for me to still transmit?
Well, the way that the trials were run for all of these drugs didn't measure for protecting against transmission, which means technically all we know is that they protect against severe disease. So in fact, we don't know for sure that it will even protect you against catching the disease. We just know that it will protect you against getting very sick from it. But just about everybody who works in the field and has, you know, looked at the data closely understands or expects that this will have a quite profound, dramatic protection against transmission as well. It just wasn't what the trial was designed to discover. So we can't say with scientific certainty that it does that. Nevertheless, it does protect against severe disease, which means that your chances of, you know, getting very sick and having to go to the hospital are reduced, practically speaking, to zero. And because of the way that this is getting technical, but because of the way that viral load plays into how transmissible, how much you can transmit the disease, presumably it would also dramatically reduce, even if you were to catch the disease, it would dramatically reduce your ability to transmit it to others. But, you know, technically the trials have not even looked at the question of transmission. So technically we can't say for sure.
My understanding was that the Pfizer vaccine didn't look at it at all, but Moderna did some of that and found that it wasn't transmissible. Or is that an overstatement?
It's sort of like different ways of looking at the same data. The data was compiled not to target transmission, but you're able to do some analysis about the data that you did find, and there are signs that it is exactly as everybody expected, protecting against transmission. But again, I think not to a level that, you know, scientists would feel comfortable stating definitively, but in the sense of like the way that they'd be advising their families and friends, everybody is assuming that it does offer that protection.
Okay, so fair enough. All right, so let's talk about the deployment, because I mean, it's almost like I was going to say, like, what's the plan? And that's part of the problem.
Yeah, in this sense, it's really, you know, the same story as we've had throughout the pandemic. I think it was back in April, May, March, I wrote a story called There Is No Plan. I wrote a follow-up in May that was called There's Still No Plan. That was about combating the disease. There was no federal oversight. There was no federal testing policy. There was no procurement of PPE policy. There was no federal quarantine policy. None of these things that you'd want to see, no federal testing and tracing, contact tracing program put into place. And we've basically seen that same indifference play out throughout the year, where the federal government has basically said to the states, we're not going to help you at all. We're not going to organize any of this. We're not going to buy any of it. And that is played out again in the vaccine distribution. But similarly, as was the case earlier in the year, you know, I don't think it's entirely fair to blame only the federal government, because the states have also dropped the ball on this, and local communities have also dropped the ball on this. You know, 3 months ago, 4 months ago, New York State Andrew Cuomo knew that Donald Trump was not going to be building out a elaborate federal vaccination program. He knew that the vaccine was going to be available sometime later in the fall. And the state has actually done very little to prepare. And New York is not at all alone in this. Nearly, you know, basically none of the states across the country have stood up a sort of, to my mind, satisfactory vaccine rollout. In fact, we're doing so badly, you know, we've got 40 million doses. That's 20 million people who are supposed to be vaccinated. And I think the current number is that we've administered about 4.5 or 5 million doses. This is taking so long to roll out that there's risk in some parts of the country, given what the storage capacity is, that the vaccine doses that we've all been waiting all year for are actually going to expire before they're administered to people. Now, it's also the case that almost no one in the world is managing this rollout any better than the U.S. is. In fact, on a per capita basis, the U.S. is ranked second in the speed of our rollout. But we're so far behind the first country, Israel, that it does beg the question of why we couldn't be doing much better, especially given, to my mind, how much apparent demand there is. And, you know, the truth is, I think as the pandemic teaches us overall, there are obvious failures of leadership at the federal level. Like I would be the last person to apologize for Donald Trump's leadership throughout this year or on any issue. But we can't assume that simply getting Donald Trump out of office is sufficient, because we're seeing really broken, you know, institutions throughout the American, you know, American social life, American political life, failing our citizens really at every level. And I think that, you know, this is ultimately the biggest lesson of the pandemic, is that we've all failed, not just the president. And one way in which we're failing is by, you know, not being able to administer the vaccine doses that we have, which, you know,
it's just a story I saw in the Albany Times. I guess this was from 2 weeks ago now. In New York, that there were county health departments who were saying, essentially off the record, like, this is messed up, that Andrew Cuomo is insisting on having the vaccine distribution go through the hospitals and then presumably, I guess, through pharmacies, big chain pharmacies. where we, as county health department officials, have received millions of dollars worth of training on how to set up for this exact event. I mean, I think you mentioned in your piece that the smallpox vaccine in New York, I guess, how many years ago was
75 years ago, basically.
Was administered to 4 million people, 5 million people in a matter of weeks? In a week. So, I mean, it's doable, but you have already these county officials who part of their training has been to set up, presumably like drive-through vaccination things. I guess you'd have a parking lot where people have to wait a half hour to see if they don't have an adverse reaction. And Cuomo's not doing that. And, you know, there's this sort of like big question mark as to why that is the case. But we all know, or at least I'm aware, that that one of, you know, Cuomo's big donors are these hospital conglomerates. One of them, I think it's Northwell, has been one of the few medical institutions that's been suing their own patients for non-payment, despite the fact that there is a statewide moratorium on that. It's quite obvious that if I'm a hospital and I'm administering the vaccines, somebody's going to be paying me money to do that, and I'm going to take a vig. And that's what's going on here, right? I mean, is that we money is interfering with not just like the conception of plans, but plans that have already been laid, presumably for this very instance.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I read it a little more generously in the sense of, you know, what's the H.L. Mencken quote, like, whatever the man, you know, I don't even remember what it is, but, you know, basically like, money is going to make people think that their interests are different than they are. That's a total, a restatement of that. But, you know, Cuomo is a man who has governed in the kind of McKinsey spirit. He has a lot of people around him who really believe in the goodness and the efficacy of corporate forces and corporate institutions in America. You know, I'm sure that people around him are connected to him, are making money off of this in ways that they might be deprived of that money if things were managed more through local health boards. On the other hand, I also think he probably genuinely believes that this is the best way to do it. But it is astonishing and horrifying, whatever the motivations are, that we had, institutions ready to go that are not being asked to operate in according to the way that they were trained. And, you know, I hesitate to put too much blame on any individual anywhere. You know, I think Cuomo has in a lot of ways done a bad job managing the pandemic in New York. You know, obviously we had by far the worst experience in the spring, and he oversaw that. On the other hand, when I look around the country, and indeed when I look across, you know, Europe too, to our peer countries, I just see so few examples of people who are handling this well. Mm-hmm. And that to me points to a much more systemic failure of state capacity and trust in government to do any of the things that we would want government entities to be doing, those things that the private market can't provide. And I think that's in part the result of a, you know, generations long hollowing out of those government institutions. It's also a result of a generations long hollowing out of public trust in those institutions. And it's really, really toxic. We're seeing now throughout this pandemic, but maybe especially in terms of the vaccine rollout, just how consequential it can be when nobody knows how to do anything and the public doesn't trust anybody to do anything. And we're basically all on our own in, you know, if you were to like open an economics textbook, economics 101, it's like, this is the kind of crisis that markets can't solve on their own. And yet, you know, you have Jared Kushner in the White House saying markets will solve this problem. And you have governors and mayors all the way down the line, basically turning it over to private entities and turning it over to individuals. It's just catastrophic. It's been totally catastrophic.
And of course, there's a sort of a feedback loop here. Like, if something in a new administration is about really the best you can get in terms of like a mulligan, at least in the minds of, I think, the public in terms of the efficacy of government in this type of situation. So, David, congratulations. I've just named you the vaccine czar for Joe Biden. And he has told me to inform you that whatever you want, you get. What do you do?
Well, the actual concrete infrastructure that I want to build out is sort of like the stepping stone to what I really believe it needs to happen, which is that American society needs to treat the next month as essentially, at its core, a project of vaccinating the entire country, which is to say that, like, you know, we can't have vaccination stands that only operate during working hours or not over the weekends or not on holidays. We need to be going out to finding people where they are rather than waiting for them to come to us. You know, the stat you mentioned about polio, which is really striking, that, you know, 5 million New Yorkers were vaccinated within a single week in 1947. That's because the whole city was organized around the goal of vaccination. That needs to be the goal of our entire country right now. You know, it's not more important to work. It's not more important even to see your family or maybe even to go out and buy food for yourself than it is to be vaccinated. And that needs to be the profound orienting mission at every level of not just government, but our society. If we do that, we could vaccinate the country in relatively short order. The problem is we're trying to do it on the side of all the other stuff that we're trying to do, and that's just proving completely ineffective. Now, I mentioned Israel earlier. They really are the sort of gold standard here. They will be, by the end of January, sufficiently vaccinated. They will have eliminated something like 9/10 of their national fatality risk just by the end of January. Wow. Now, they're a smaller country, but these things are all, you know, administered on per capita basis too. If you're a bigger country, it also means you have more people to do the work. So there's no reason why a smaller country should be able to do it more quickly than a big one. The U.S. is more, you know, it's a more rural country. There are some complications, but we should aim for that kind of program where we have hundreds of thousands of federally mandated and directed vaccinators all around the country, not waiting for citizens to come to them, but seeking them out and making sure that everybody who is comfortable taking a vaccine gets one as quickly as possible. We can't just wait for things to sort themselves out. It's you know, we're in much too big. You mentioned that, you know, the transition to a new administration. Even since Election Day, we've had something like 75,000 people, Americans, die. By the time of inauguration, we'll probably be well north of 100,000. And if we fast forward the next couple of months, those numbers could grow dramatically. These delays of a week or 2 weeks, which may not seem so consequential to you and me when we think about our individual lives, are unbelievably consequential at the social level, because we're talking about tens of thousands of additional people dying every single week that we delay. So we need to be treating the vaccination program with that kind of urgency, with, you know, not to peddle in sort of cliche, but with a kind of war mobilization approach.
All right. So, and let me just, so let me make one point too, that there, that Israel has received significant criticism, I think, for prioritize, or I should say for deprioritizing vaccination for Palestinians living in the occupied territories. So, I mean, I just that needs to be said in terms of their rollout. Presumably.
Absolutely. But I would just say, just as a sort of like, can this model work? You know,
Yes, I understand. And the Palestinians in the occupied territories are still probably going to get the vaccine before, you know, the vast majority of Americans are going to be getting it. But that's not an excuse. I mean, the society should be decided, you know, should be judged within the equity and justice within the context of that society. But as a mechanism, as an argument of mechanism, the point remains. So, but would that start, well, what you're talking about, this war footing, would start with the Defense Production Act, right? I mean, the Joe Biden on day one could say, okay, Defense Production Act, we're going to take over this facility. Like, do we have, if he invoked the Defense Production Act, where he had the ability to go in and say, I want a list on day one, and he's saying this to Ron Klain, I guess, I want a list on day one of the 10 factories across the country that can be converted on day one into making this vaccine so that we can have, you know, these things, you know, 24/7 chugging it out. Like, has anybody done that? Like, is there anybody out there who's done these, that crunched these numbers, has the list so that on, you know, so that Joe Biden's sitting there with, like, you know, here's the directions. As soon as I get in there, this is literally the first thing I do. And then we're going to hire, how many people they need to hire? 100,000? how long will it take to ramp that stuff up? I mean, what are like the actual practical machinations here?
What he said is that he wants to vaccinate 100 million people in the first 100 days. And that is much, much better than we've been doing so far when we've been a little over a million people a week. So it's ramping up by a factor of 7. But it still means that the country won't be practically protected at any level approaching herd immunity until deep into the summer at the very earliest. We're a country of 350 million people roughly. We're talking about probably needing to vaccinate at least 300 million to really feel comfortable that the disease has been adequately suppressed. So, 100 million in 100 days sounds great, but it only gets us a third of the way there. And by that time, we're already into April. It's not nearly as fast as we need to go. At the current pace though, we're only on schedule to reach herd immunity in like 5 years. So Biden's existing plan is a huge improvement on that, but we could be doing much, much better. What worries me more than the production of the vaccine and how to ramp that up is that we are currently letting doses that we have go unused and possibly expiring. To me, that's the first priority, is how to make sure that we deliver the vaccines that we have before they go bad and we waste them. Yeah.
Like, so when we only have a couple minutes left here, but how would you do that? Like, for instance, we have a Cuomo, issuing, and I understand the impetus behind it. These are sort of draconian fines. If anybody gets the vaccine who's not in, the specific, list of people who should be getting it in priority list. But I mean, shouldn't the idea be we just get as much as we can and we see an arm and we just stick a needle in it?
Well, I think to some degree that sounds reasonable. You might want to prioritize the elderly. There are arguments for prioritizing healthcare workers too, but when you're in a situation where the resources you have, the vaccine doses that you have, are going unused, much better to stick those doses into any arm you can find rather than waiting for someone who happens to qualify to walk into your clinic. And so, in theory, you could set up a situation where on top of the existing infrastructure that's been set up to reach out to those people with priority, there was also a kind of like a waiting list. So at the end of the day, your unused doses, you could walk over to your city MD or your local health clinic or your local hospital, and maybe today they've got 50 extra doses to give out, and maybe tomorrow they've got 75. And depending on how the rollout goes, that could end up significantly increasing the number of protected people in relatively short order. But of course, we need to multiply the number of doses we are producing in addition to delivering all of those that we have. So we've got a couple of big projects ahead of us, and the faster we do it, the better off the country will be.
Do you see any, if we're looking for, green shoots on something like that or some moment of hope, like where do we look? Or is it just, hope that Joe Biden gets in there on day one and they just, they surprise everybody with he gets on TV that night, and says, this is what we're going to do. We're going to shut down for 3 weeks and we're going to just roll this out. I mean, is that basically it?
The way I see it, local officials, governors, mayors have been moving also, especially over the last week since this story has sort of provoked a lot of outrage across the country. So I think things are already moving faster than they were. And as I mentioned, on a per capita basis, we're second in the world, which is really depressing to consider given how slow things are moving. But ultimately, yeah, I think that the biggest push can come from the federal government. And that means waiting until January 20th and then probably some period of time, a few weeks beyond that, before whatever, human and non-human infrastructure needs to be stood up really can be stood up. And that's one of the great tragedies of the electoral calendar, that we have this incredibly long lame duck period in which probably 150,000 or more Americans will die than would have had to if Joe Biden had taken over on November 5th.
In the month of January. I mean, those are the projections. Yeah. It's absolutely heartbreaking.
David Wallace Wells, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. We'll put a link to your pieces in New York Magazine at majority.fm. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
Always fascinating, almost equally as depressing to talk to David Wallace Wells. Yep. Every time we've interviewed him, whether it's about COVID or about global warming. Let's take a break. We'll come back and we will... We will return to the happy talk of, at the very least, that Joe Biden is not, there's going to be a lot of things off of Joe Biden's plate that could have been obstructive so that he can get to this issue of COVID right away. We'll be right back. So, you know, I mean, that is the thing that I think is very, it's a little bit more opaque. This notion of Biden does not have to, and we should say, my understanding is it's now being reported that Biden is going to, choose Merrick Garland as the next attorney general. The idea being here, and he was, it seemed to have been between Doug Jones and Merrick Garland.
Yeah.
And
Sally Yates got sidelined.
Yes. And frankly, Doug Jones would have been a better pick in my estimation than Merrick Garland. But Merrick Garland sits on the D.C. Circuit Court. This is considered to be the most important court in the country, short of the Supreme Court. And one of the things, with the knowledge that it appears that the Democrats will have control of the Senate, that it frees Joe Biden up to do, is to appoint a successor to Merrick Garland. They would not have chosen Merrick Garland,
right,
if they did not have control of the Senate and had the ability to replace him without a problem. Remember, filibusters are gone now for federal judges and a Supreme Court justice. So I would have preferred Doug Jones, but this is indicative of a whole host of things that Joe Biden is no longer going to have to be concerned with. And the energy, and by Joe Biden, I mean the administration, is going to have to be concerned with, and can focus all of its resources and all of its thought. Now, obviously, there's other things that has to happen in our government, but they don't have to worry about, and I said this yesterday, about, you know, seating the Secretary of Education or seating the Health and Human Services or worrying about a fight over who will be, at least a fight with the Republicans in any position in the cabinet or judges. This is going to make a lot of things easier, and it's going to leave room, hopefully, for Joe Biden to dedicate the mental, physical, not just his, but the administration's resources, dedicated like a laser on this question of vaccinations, both as a policy matter to save American lives, to help the American economy, but also as a political matter. You've got 2 years to prove to the American public that this was a good idea.
Right.
To elect Warnock and Ossoff. And you're not going to be able to get a lot of legislation through. We're going to talk more about that tomorrow. But you get this done right, it is at least exhibit A of the value of government and a Biden administration and a democratically controlled one. We will talk more about this tomorrow, and we will see you then. Except for those of you who are sticking around.
Sticking around crew, huh?
Yeah, the sticking around crew. Now, listen, my understanding is, and Brenda, do we know this, that the attempt to, delegitimize Joe Biden's win, is that taking place now in
underway?
The Senate?
We're pulling up the live video momentarily.
Okay, so we may have some of this live coverage throughout, because this should be fun. Now, Mike Pence has been, I can tell you that the right wing echo chamber, as it were, is convinced that Mike Pence has the ability to stand up and say, I throw all of this off. It is not, the Electoral College will not be confirmed. I hereby invalidate the election. And Mike Pence is saying, like, well, I don't really have an ability to do that. And so that's what we're going to see. And then we've got a video of Donald Trump saying the idea that Pence can't do it is BS. And I don't mean BS. But we will get to that in the fun half. Oh, is this okay? So there it's going on.
Electors of the several states for president and vice president of the United States. After ascertainment has been had that the certificates are authentic and correct in form, the tellers will count and make a list of the votes cast by the electors of the several states. The tellers on the part of the two houses have taken their places at the clerk's desk. Without objection, the tellers will dispense with the reading of the formal portions of the certificates. After ascertaining that the certificates are regular in form and authentic, the tellers will announce the votes cast by the electors for each state, beginning with Alabama.
The thing to note,
parliamentarians advise me, is the only certificate of vote.
The thing to note here is that he made a big deal. I'm just going to be reading the script. He wants to make this seem like this is completely pro forma. It is. But he wants to make this like it's completely pro forma. And so he's going to be have his face in the script.
Yes,
so
I'm very official. I'm very official.
It's completely out of my hands, what he's saying. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. When you become a member, you support not only the free show, but we give you extra content every day. We cannot do it without you. And so thank you to those folks who have signed up to be members, and you can do so at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, the AM Quickie is available for your listening pleasure every single day, even when we're on vacation on days, most of the time. This morning, Dorsey got it out before 7 a.m.
Wow.
Because it was such big news.
Wow.
But it's 6 or 7 minutes. It gives you your day's worth of news right in that amount of time. It's all completely free. You can find it AM Quickie on your podcast servers. Don't forget, Nomiki's show. I'm not sure who's on today, but obviously a lot to talk about with the
Nina Turner is on today. Here's who's on.
Nina Turner? Wow.
Wow. What a big get.
What's she doing? That's like
his screen share is all glitched out, but cool.
So Nina Turner on Nomiki's show today. You can find that at youtube.com/thenomikishow. Wow, that is exciting. I'm going to tune in for that one. And also, don't forget, the Antifada, patreon.com/theantifada. And they are streaming on their Twitch channel, twitch.tv/theantifada. Matt, what's up with the, Matt Leck media empire?
Yeah. Last night on the Left Reckoning Twitch feed, I listened to the full Trump call to the Georgia Republicans at 0.9 speed. And that was very enjoyable. I did that while playing Cyberpunk. And on tomorrow night, we're having kind of the first official show where we have a guest and everything. And the guest is Malaika Jabali. We're going to be talking about how to actually push this array of, you know, now that Democrats have the Senate, what do we do? So we're going to be talking about that tomorrow night, Left Reckoning on the YouTube page.
Man, we're getting scooped all over the place, Brendan. What the heck?
Oh, well, yeah.
Scheduled her twice. Also, tonight, the Antifada is doing a Twitch stream at 7 p.m. So you can check that out at twitch.tv/theantifada. All right, quick break. Head into the fun half. We're going to watch Mike Pence stick a knife in Donald Trump's back.
Wow.
RM for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danerke song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Fuck. Reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? All
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black. African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't not hustle.
Come on! Fuck 'em, fuck 'em, fuck 'em, fuck 'em, fuck 'em, fuck 'em.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.